Hi, I'm Andrew Proctor, and you're listening to a special episode of the Archive Project, in which we're featuring events from 2017's Portland Book Festival, presented by Bank of America. The 2018 lineup has just been announced, and the festival will take place on November 10th in downtown Portland. For more information about the author lineup, schedule, and tickets, visit literary-arts.org. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. This is a special episode of the Archive Project in which we bring you the show in three parts. Each year, on the eve of our book festival, we present an evening of events called Lit Crawl PDX. It's essentially a literary bar crawl. In 2017, it had 32 events scheduled over 3 hours in locations across downtown Portland. Literary Arts partners with dozens of local and national organizations to present events that range in format from poetry performances to oddball bookish game shows to staged readings. The tone of these events ranges from the serious to the ridiculous, from the political to the personal, and everything in between. What Lit Crawl PDX showcases is how alive and engaged our writers are with the diverse concerns and preoccupations of our community, both locally and nationally. It's a reminder that literature can be an intensely serious art form, but also one full of humor, irony, and self-deprecation. Lit Crawl is an eclectic mix of all the amazing things literature can be, and by bringing it into bars and other non-traditional spaces, we hope to give audiences an engaging, disarming, and fun way to experience the work of some incredible writers at all stages of their careers. So this episode is meant to give you a taste of what it's like to attend Lit Crawl PDX, which took place at our book festival in November 2017. In this first segment, we feature four poets who participated in a reading called Words as Victim and Weapon. The title is drawn from a quote from National Book Award-winning poet Robin Cost Lewis, in which she says, quote, "Language is one of the most powerful weapons of war. It is also one of the war's first victims." The reading was co-hosted by DeCannon, A Visibility Project, White Noise, and Yes Yes Books. And in this episode, we're featuring readings from Nabila Lovelace, Alyssa Ogie, Dinez Smith, and Mahogany Brown.
We'd like to begin actually with the quote that inspired this particular reading. It actually comes from an old classmate of mine who has gone on to very big and fantastic things, Robin Costa Lewis. We take our inspiration from her quote here. The history of English is inextricably tied to the history of war, to the history of empire. They cannot be separated. And hence, our literature cannot be separated from these histories. Language is one of the most powerful weapons of war. It is also one of the war's first victims. And our first reader will be Nabila Lovelace.
Hey y'all, what's good? So this first poem is a longer poem and is really thinking about the cyclical nature of violence and language and war, actually, in terms of the theme. So yeah, thank you all. Your neighbor's ex-boyfriend says he'd pay to see that, referring to your previous admission to lay hands on Caroline across the way's husband if he blackened her eye or so much as a yelp for help extends from her mouth. You say you'd fight, but inside you promise rain of blood, of blows. You are the second coming of your limbs when the circulation can't slow. Enraged, the list is long with men you want to excise. Your aunt's ex-husband, Terrell from the fifth grade, that one uncle, and here a 47-looking, 35-year-old white man offers to patron your bludgeon of a stand-in for the long list. All of the men from the past and each tooth you can pluck right up from their gums. This is an offer you cannot refuse. White men of the world filling your pocket with big bills to watch you blotch the skin where it was smooth. And what an enticing trap, money. Violence will drive you off a steep staircase on wobbly wheels. You know the way it bloats your muscles, but Caroline's husband is the scum that which other scum eats its dinner off. And her 17-year-old son says he's afraid he will hit her again tonight. A lush plead, please don't leave. And you want to solve this with the one solution you know. Blood, blood, blood. Instead, you are swilled with swigs of beer. You are no hero. Your mouth a mulch of butterscotch. Who do you hold your fists back for? You have recurring nightmares where there is a man holding you underwater. He wants to take, and you cannot land a scratch, not a punch, much the way you exit Caroline's house, her husband and sons behind you. Your name, Nabila, means noble. The door closes behind you. Where is your name now? Thank you.
Our next reader is Alyssa Ogi.
Hello. This first one is called Tree Haibun, and a haibun is a prose poem that ends in a haiku. Here it goes. A professor says that my poetry is too preoccupied with race. There's nothing timeless about sensationalism, and he quotes Coleridge as if Coleridge parroted the words of God. He tells me to examine pine trees for wisdom. In this system, I'm expected to be the best, expected to be obedient enough to excel, and I do. At everything, at once, not only on paper, but in the stall of a library toilet, where I throw up the words I've swallowed down all day. The burn feels natural, as if my great-great-grandmothers taught me how to purge in a dream. No one said that it'd feel cathartic, that the damage might be intentional. I'm preoccupied with my skin color in the light and the weight of excellence around my belly. So yes, profess admiration that I can be the opposite of dangerous and the opposite of safe at once. Profess that a man snuck a hand up a modest skirt hem on a Los Angeles bus and I couldn't stop him, crushed by other passengers. I don't know what he looked like, though his cologne smelled like pine trees. I don't know why a man stopped my lover and me once as we exited the Chandler Pavilion in our nicest clothes. Salieri's The Great Kublai Khan of the Tartars premiered, and actors taped back their eyelids. We left early to catch our bed. The strange man had dimples like mine and asked where he could buy a girl like me in the city. No one knew where that question was directed. At a blonde-haired American, at a black-haired American, at a preoccupied laugh track long since discarded. Two men laughed, and one woman draped a sweater over her obedient dress, with beadwork that resembled trees along its hem. On the walk towards our metro line, love reached for me. Love told me that some people like to get a rise out of others. I named the insult sensational, but it came out as timeless. Love reached for me and said I was overreacting, so I did what I do best. Pine bends in snowstorms until it breaks in the summer, ill-prepared for warmth. Thank you.
Our next reader is Dinez Smith.
So back in this time last year, white people voted for the apocalypse. And ever since then, there's been like this lovely practice of calling everything else that's good my president that I really like. I think I first saw it with Rihanna. So I wrote this poem about all the many different presidents I have. It was inspired by meeting this fly-ass 11-year-old named Jonathan, who runs like a multicultural arts org at his school and like does all this. He's so tight. And so I had to write him a poem. It also mentions Eve Ewing, who is a brilliant poet and sociologist from Chicago. The end of this poem is borrowed by a brilliant poet and my president, Angel Nafis. All right, cool. Today, I elect Jonathan. 11 and already making roads out of water. Young genius, blog writer, little community activist, curls tight as pinky swears, black as my nation. I trust the world in his tender, blooming hands. I trust him to tell us which rivers are safe to drink and which hold fish like a promise. I elect Eve Ewing, who I know would misfrizzle the out this country into one big-ass classroom where the grandmas finger-paint the national budget and uncles stand around smoking blacks, plotting the stars for our escape. She could walk to the front of the podium at her inauguration and say, the future is now, and the sun, and we would all marvel as the sun and moon started looping the sky like a gif, as the cars learned to fly and our skin grew bulletproof. And Colin Kaepernick is my president, who kneels on the air, bent towards a branch, throwing apples down to the children. And Rihanna is my president, walking out of global summits with a wine glass in hand, paying back our tax returns and gold to dust our faces into coins. And my mama is my president, her grace that makes even amazing seem dull, her hands breaking bread over the mouths of the hungry until there are no more unfed. And my grandma is my president, and her cabinet is her cabinet, because she knows. Because she knows to trust what the pan knows, what the skillet knows of war. And the man I saw high kicking down by the river as he ran, he is my president. And the trans girl making songs in her closet, spinning the dark into a booming dress, she too is my president. And Shonda Rhimes is my president. And Nate Marshall is my president. And Trina is my president. And the boys outside Walgreens selling candy for a possibly fictional basketball team, they too, they too are my presidents. And the bus driver who stops after you yell wait only twice is my prez. And the dude at the pizza shop who will give you an extra slice if you are down to wait until he finishes the day's fourth prayer, he too is my president. And my auntie, only clean for a few months but clean, she is my president. And my neighbor who holds the door open when my arms are full of laundry is my president. And every head nod is my president. And every child singing with a red sweet tongue is my president. And the birds and the cooks and the single moms especially, and the drug dealers and the teachers and the meter maids who let you slide especially, and the cab drivers who stop and the nurses' swollen feet and the braiders' exhausted hands and the bartender and Beyonce and all her kids and the rabbi and the sad girls and the leather daddy who always says good morning and the boy who is crying on the train and the woman who rubs his back and the man who offers him water and the woman who begins to hum, oh, my presidents, my presidents, my presidents, my presidents, show me to your nation. My only border is my body. I say all your names like a mighty anthem. I pledge love every day. I pledge love.
Last, we have Mahogany Brown.
Thank you. I, too, have a different president. If 2017 was a poem title, one, when they turn bodegas into boutique grocery stores, when they bounce cops up the block like this hipster protection program won't turn back Lefrak into Harlem, turn back Harlem into Chirac, turn back Bed-Stuy into Brownsville, turn Brownsville back into the Bronx, back into Gaza, back. You will taste this strange and bitter American history, where the mom and pop work more hours than the governor, where the pesticides overflow our sewer systems, float our neighborhoods until food deserts, one way in, one way out. Tell me this gentrification be for my own good. Tell me this housing project keep us warfare ready. Tell me Biggie died for our sins, and I'll show you a Brooklyn stoop with the baby's name etched in chalk, a hashtag ghost gone already, a price tag on his sister's face. She's been missing since Sunday, where chopper lights paint concrete, a trail of breadcrumbs. The haunting finds its way back to our homes. One, the Electoral College is a lullaby designed to put us back to sleep. One, the ocean is weeping, a righteous rage. She got questions for the living. And what about the sweetheart who would grow to love Tamir Rice? Mike Brown, Corinne Gaines, Akai Gurley. What about their mama singing their name before each breakfast? Or the church praying for their redemption, Bibles raised in the air? What about they almost children? How about they daddy smile? What about their name makes them so easy to turn to ash? How we ghosting black boys for the toys we gift them? One, on a Monday, a white body told my black body it ain't earned no apology for the bloodshed. For the nights when my skin grows so cold, I know I must be inches from death. For each death hand delivered to me, this silence, this certain dismissal, this post-racial reality show, this Confederate hug, and don't it bloom? Don't it bloom like a mushroom sky? What about the blues? Why I cry like hell? Why it hail like America so long? One, yo, America, what you know about noose ready? What you know about chalk lines and double barrels? What you know about a murder weapon or a loose cigarette or a baby sleeping on a couch? What you know about the flag, the truck that followed me down a lonely road in Georgia, the names that I rolled off my tongue in prayer? Saint Sojourner, Saint Harriet, Saint Rakia, Saint Sandra, bring me home. Or leave me steady, gun aimed and cocked ready, con artist turned 45th resident of the White House, while the 44th president is lifted off the grounds by his shadow with his black wife. She truth slayer all day, she cheekbone slay, while the media aiming shot at a presidential legacy until weed smoke and a concert makes us remember black people ain't never been human here. Ain't we beautiful? Those that survived the purging, those that spill bodies play glorious from a hateful, hateful song. This swing, sweet, sweet, low spiritual ain't never been inclusive. What you know about larynx and baton? How you sing him crow in the key of Emmett Till? What fever fussed you awake? Who else got cop anxiety? Call it what it is. Call it post-traumatic slave syndrome. Call it land tax until homelessness. Call it abortion turned sterilization. Ain't no lie. Like the one against our stillborn children. Ain't no lie. Like the many that shaped our babies into mute cattle. Prison industrial complex reverberates in the tune of elementary. Third graders are their easiest targets. One, a math problem. If one woman got a 7 Mac 11 and 2 heaters for the Beamer, how many Congress seats will the NRA lose? How many votes will it take for a sexual predator to lift the White House off her feet? One. I am practicing this aim, my tongue a shoestring strafe. My tongue say melt the wires of Guantanamo. Yasin Bey coming home ain't what we thought it would be. Ain't no solace in Mecca, even Spike Lee left Brooklyn here. A slumlord will leave my front steps full of rat piss, an Airbnb my neighbor's apartment for half my take-home pay. Unhinge the city of Rikers, bring back the Reapers. Give them the loot and the stoop. Yeah, they good at killing, but so was Jefferson. I mean, Washington, I mean, CIA, I mean, COINTELPRO. I mean, they mimic your grace. I mean, it's 2017, America, a new year, and your facelift be botched.
You're listening to a special episode of the Archive Project, in which we're featuring events from LitCrawl PDX, which took place as part of our book festival in November 2017. In this next segment, we'll shift gears completely and skip over to an event called Little Boxes, which is a celebration of an anthology of, quote, cultural criticism from people who grew up with a television as their primary background noise. We're going to hear from the actor and writer Elena Passarello, who won a Whiting Award in 2015 and was a finalist for the 2014 Oregon Book Award. Here's Passarello.
So my essay for Caroline's book was about the TV show Northern Exposure. Yeah? Okay, great, yeah. Which I kind of feel like maybe, I'm not from the Pacific Northwest, but I think I ended up here either because of Twin Peaks or Northern exposure. When you're a young kid, like, watching, or also I got a job here, but I don't know, like, I was a young kid in Georgia, like, watching Twin Peaks and Northern exposure, and I was like, this is where I want to be. So I found out that that town where they filmed Northern Exposure is like a place in Washington State. It's Roslyn. Has anybody else been? Yeah. So we, my handsome boyfriend and I went to Roslyn to try to figure out if we could sort of walk in the footsteps of Maggie, the bush pilot, and Dr. Joel Fleischman and Ruth Ann and all those fun people. And I'll just read a little bit about our entrance. The essay ends up being about all the music that was in Northern Exposure. And how, you know, if you get the DVDs of Northern Exposure, all of that music is gone because they didn't get the licensing. So when you watch that, it's one of those TV shows that you can kind of never revisit. And of course, Roslyn, Washington is not in Sicily, Alaska. So Sicily, Alaska is another place that you can't visit. You can only sort of go there. That's kind of what the essay is about, but I'll just read kind of our entrance in and why I like Northern Exposure as a kid. I didn't plan it this way, but our walk into Roslyn followed that of Mort, the adolescent moose that clomps through an empty Roslyn in the show's opening credits. Coming from the Northwest, we hung a right at Village Pizza, strolling down Pennsylvania Avenue and looking for antlers nailed over the shop's doors. We spotted the blue clapboard building with Dr. Joe Fleischman still lettered into the window and crossed the street just as Mort did. The famous Roslyn Cafe mural, an oasis, rose up the brick wall to our right. It was all still there. I played the pokey harmonica theme song in my head as we about-faced, quitting Mort's path and heading east on Pennsylvania toward the K-Bear, K-B-H-R, radio window display. In addition to having no social life, I'm not sure how much of an aesthetic life I had, I enjoyed at age 13, which is when Northern Exposure aired. Though my slate was all but blank, I did possess a dawning sense of how much there was to learn. With no older siblings and parents who only owned Christmas cassettes and the Pretty Woman soundtrack, I looked to TV and to the college radio stations my boombox barely detected as curatorial fairy godmothers. I could wake up in the middle of the night with my radio still playing WRAS, Album 88, The Voice of Georgia State, and a low voice might introduce three versions of Tighten Up back to back and then recite the liner notes to A Love Supreme and then cue an old B-52's track. I kept a blank tape in the deck at all times and turned off the radio only when my mom made me. Sometimes I watched TV with a notebook in my hand so I could write down intriguing one-liners like, the owls are not what they seem, or soundtrack lyrics that someone might identify for me later. This was before Google, of course. As a slightly lonely and definitely bottled up kid, music was how my heart felt the most open. My preteen journals ignore any conflict in my life and just feature these rhapsodic sentences on all the cool stuff coming in on various airwaves and how desperate I was to be introduced to more of it. I know that in many bedrooms near mine, kids were finding The Cure and Pump Up the Volume to explore their moodiness, but for me, all that came later. In the very early 90s, pop culture was my vehicle for optimism. All the imaginative stories and inventive sounds that I knew were out there, though not yet within my reach. So it makes sense that I would adore the good-natured Northern Exposure, with its pretentious loners, its elusive dream sequences, and its significant attention to diegetic sound. The show even has a DJ woven into its ensemble, Chris, an affable ex-con turned sculptor and the sexiest Sicilian by an Alaska mile. The whole town listens to Chris. Presumably K-Bear is the only station for miles. And so as the events of each episode unfold and interweave, Chris's playlist for the town underscores them. What's more, the characters use music to make unexpected connections. The eclectic nature of the K-Bear playlist, the cultural gaps between a Django Reinhardt song beneath one scene and a Grandmaster Flash song in the next, they often reflect the odd pairings of Sicilians who find themselves stuck in plotlines together. K-Bear, for example, plays Moonlight Sonata through Ruth Ann's store while she warns Dr. Fleischman about Adam, Sicily's resident Bigfoot. Who Put the Bomb blasts from the doctor's clock radio the morning his snobby fiancé arrives. On Thanksgiving, Carl Smith's Let Old Mother Nature Have Her Way wasps through the brick as Chris describes to Shelley the waitress the concept of Weltschmerz, feeling the pain of something missing from your world, even though you can't quite put your finger on what. And I know Scorsese did this kind of pointed scoring a decade before Northern Exposure, but I hadn't watched Goodfellas yet. I was 13 years old. I was babysitting people's kids so they could go see Goodfellas. From the perspective of my small and uninformed life, Northern Exposure was the first piece of culture that loved music as much as I did. And it was so much smarter and worldlier than I was about it. A quarter century later, it doesn't feel like much of a stretch to remember the 6 seasons of that show as my sentimental education. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Andrew Proctor, and you're listening to a special episode of the Archive Project, in which we're featuring events from LitCrawl PDX, which took place as part of our book festival in November 2017. In this last segment of our show, we bring you a conversation about collaboration. For writer Deb Olin Unferth, this was the first time she'd written a graphic novel. She teamed up with Portland artist Elizabeth Hadel to create the book I, Parrot. Their collaboration was unusually close, given that they did not know each other before the project. In fact, so close, they ended up living in the same house for several months while they worked on the book. Their conversation reveals the way they inspired and influenced each other as they worked, making a visual and written story that could not have existed without the collaboration. Here's Unferth.
So we're just going to do this little 10-minute slide presentation where we're going to tell you a little bit about the book's origins and how the great Elizabeth Hadel came up with all of the artwork, and we'll talk about the collaboration process. So the reason that I started thinking about writing this book was that I was reading Parrots for Dummies, you know, about like how to take care of parrots. I don't have a parrot, but I thought, I honestly have no idea why I was reading that book. And so I was reading this book and it was so beautiful because I felt like the person who had written it was someone who thought that birds don't belong in cages. It just seemed like as you read that she really believed deeply that you should not have a bird in a cage. And yet she had this assignment of writing this book about keeping a bird in a cage. And I could feel that tension all over the book. And it just broke my heart. And so I started the book and then I put the book inside the book. And so, for example, these 2 pages here, I just took the book and I traced the book, the original Parrots for Dummies, the picture. So this is actually what it looked like. So like on one side of the page, you have this bird in a very small cage and it says, you know, put your bird in a secure carrier when taking to the vet, you know. And then on the other side, there's this thing that says, in the wild, birds fly 100 miles a day. And it's just like this, you know. So we just put that right into the book.
And it was very intensely collaborative, even though Deb had been thinking about this story for years before I came in on the scene. She made it clear that I should feel free to put myself in there. In fact, in a weird way, the main character had a number of similarities to me, and she stalked me on Facebook immediately when the publishers mentioned, and then said, oh, you know what, the character's a lot like you and your son when he was younger. So anytime there was a moment that I thought, like, what I would do, like, there's a scene where they're sleeping outside and it's everything's going wrong, so it's not like a fun camping moment. So I wanted her to tell, like, a bedtime story and do a couple things, like to make it seem all right. We also modeled the boyfriend on an ex-boyfriend of mine.
Yeah, we'll
not that he knows, but he lives far away. And one thing attracted to me to the story is that I just love surrealism. I feel like it's what makes the bitter pill of reality go down. And Deb had all these, you know, Deb had all these kind of surrealist side plots and things that started and stopped and maybe weren't fully explained. And so one of those is that the passenger pigeons come back. They were never extinct, and now they're back without anyone understanding why. And so,
I mean, the idea is, I don't know if you guys know the passenger pigeons that became extinct in I think it was 1914. There used to be so many passenger pigeons that when they flew overhead, it would blacken the sky for hours. So everyone would just be looking up, and it would just be black up there with birds flying by overhead. And we killed every single one. I mean, it was really quite an accomplishment. And their extinction kind of came around the same time as like industrialism and modernism and, you know, the Native Americans decline and in this country. And so I just thought, wouldn't it be great to just like suddenly they just start coming back, you know? They're coming back. And then when Beth was drawing, every time I would have a surreal element, she would just sort of take it and run with it and just keep expanding on it, which was so fun for me. Like, you know, her image of Portland is, she kind of twisted it and made it weird. And then like these cars, you know, look at these cars. Who parks like that? They're so weird.
Let's see. Oh, this is my personal favorite page. Deb had drawn the whole book. We'll show you all kinds of sketches in a moment. But there was this inexplicable scene with protesters coming by, and they had all made signs like in support of the passenger pigeons, and also maybe being freaked out that there could be like a re-extinction now. And I remember my son was home from school that day, and so I like to make him be my art director when I get tired of making my own decisions. Plus, he's good at it. And so I came up with all these different signs and made him tell me which ones were funny, which ones weren't. And I just was thinking, who would these people be that would, you know, sit there and make a sign and take this time? And I thought maybe there would be some ones that were like, you know, the ultimate underdog, you know, because they went extinct. So anyone who's just rooting for them, like, they're making a comeback, or maybe extinction deniers, like the bottom ones say, like, told you and look up, like, for sure. Don't shoot, of course, you know, peace for pigeons. And then I came up with this one. I thought, like, someone should say something poetic, like, we are all passengers on this earth. Anyway, it was a good memory for me.
Yeah, so these were my drawings that I handed over. You know, it was so funny because I had no idea how hard it was to do a comic. I mean, I had really no idea. It's so much harder than I thought it would be. And anytime I showed my little ridiculous drawings to a writer, they would always say, "Hey, these are pretty good. You know, you should just draw it yourself." You know, and then every time I would show it to an artist, they would be like, "So who's going to draw it for you?" And so luckily, I found Beth, but we auditioned a lot of people, and Beth's were just so far superior to anything that we saw. It's like she just connected emotionally immediately. So this just sort of shows how this one is mine, and then she's just taking it and just changing it.
We really spent two-thirds, like we had a year about for the project, and about two-thirds of it was after I came to stay with her, and we went through every page and clarified and added things and subtracted things and then came back and then still went over every panel and every emotion, and then I had 4 months at the end to get all the texture and contrast going.
So this is another example of my beautiful artwork, where she is lamenting and saying that, you know, it's like being in purgatory where they are.
There were all these extra rooms. I mean, we wanted to put the lake of fires to be expected and things like that. I just moved here. I was super pissed off by the health insurance website until I saw John Oliver made fun. And I was like, oh, I'm not the only person like alone in a room crying over this, my experience on this site. So I gave it its own room. And I don't know, it's a nice mashup of modern and ancient suffering. There were a lot of stairs in this book. There were stairs leading up to the aviary in the place where the character was pet sitting, and then there were stairwells in the apartment where they ended up. So I had a lot of time to think about stairs. I finally started to read M.C. Escher because I was like, he's the master of like surrealist stairways. And it's like it's a deep metaphor now that I've, you know, you're like suspended. You're neither here nor there. You don't know if you chose the right door half the time. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted them to be floating and nonsensical or like incredibly steep or, you know, not realistic. And Deb was so supportive of all that.
He's great. Characters.
The characters. It's 160 pages long. I had done comics and all types of art, but never something that long form. And when it comes to sometimes 10 drawings per page, I had started with these other kind of more detailed explorations of a character with pastel and inks and all these things. But quickly, I realized I needed to also figure out how to simplify and do something that was sustainable. So the finals are a little bit of ink and texture, but I did a lot of work on a tablet to actually make it all happen in this amount of time. And then, you know, I heard it was about parrots. I hardly knew anything about it when they called me, and I thought, well, I love drawing birds. This will be great. And then they said, it's in black and white. I thought, oh, so, okay, contrast and texture. And that was then a unique challenge. So this is the only page that actually has, I did do some research and got these different endangered. These are actual parrots. The rest of the book, I think I made it up.
Pretty cool. They look so colorful, even though they're not colored.
You can imagine the colors. Oh, that's great.
So it was so funny when I was talking to Beth on Skype for the first few times, and I said, you know what? The thing was that I really wanted her to just put herself into it. I didn't want it to just be my book. I wanted it to be our book. So I said, you know, just imagine yourself in this situation, which is pretty easy because, you know, you're a single mom and all this. And so, I mean, she really does. Look how much alike they look. It's crazy. And then I was said, we were talking about the boyfriend Laker, and she was like, yeah, I had a boyfriend like that once. And I was like, oh, well, like, let's make this that guy. And so we got out a picture of him, and there he is. So
sort of like him.
Oh, so these are the house painters are another kind of surreal element of the book, and they're all named Lee Anthony. And that sounds kind of surreal, but it actually happened. I was house sitting for someone, and I had to help make sure that the house painters were doing a good job or whatever. And they were all named Lee Anthony. There were four of them, and they were all named Lee Anthony. And I don't understand how that happened. They weren't brothers. So anyway, so another thing that we did for those, I mean, I think a lot of people here know Beth pretty well and know that she's in a jug band and she plays a saw. And so I was like, I cannot believe that I get this cool Portland, you know, woman who plays the saw. And so I said, well, we got to put, so then at some point, the house painters, they just break into song with their band. So,
and then I can't draw vehicles, so I just made up weird flattened. I just pretended they were made out of cardboard, and then it was easier to draw. But this one, has anyone seen this? This is like a flower delivery van, and I was like, that looks like a cartoon for real. So that was easy. I just borrowed that and made their painter van. I don't know. I'm glad I was there at the right time. These are some supporting cast characters. Only after the fact did I realize that the landlady and the boyfriend's boss, like, they look like this warped version of Popeye and Olive Oil. I don't know how. Noah, we totally just based it off of my son, but a younger version, just now 13. And so I threw random details to make him happy. Like, 4 is his lucky number. He's born on 04-04-2004. Clearly, it's his lucky number. Yeah, that's the son. Those are the main characters.
And that's the end of the this part of... Now we're going to have some Q&A. Hi guys, thanks for having me.
the process is so interesting. The collaboration process was so interesting. The thing I'm always wondering about when I read books that were collabs is like, were there ever times where you felt like one person was steering, or did it really feel like kind of back and forth organic? Like, were there pieces that felt more like a part of one of you than the other?
Well, I mean, since I'd already written the book pretty much, it was kind of, you know, it was kind of my thing, but I kept trying to just hand it over to her and just say, you know, you take up the creative reins, you know, what do you think, you know, you just go with it. And I think we did that more and more as time went on.
Interesting. So the style that you chose for this book, the visual style, was that in conversation to you with the story? Was it something like you that, or was that just like truly your style when you started?
That actually went sort of naturally. I think you seemed to like everything I was doing. But there was a lot of back and forth.
Yeah.
We had an interesting talk last night in Austin about a lot of creators wanting to know, like, how can you deal with, like, the loss of total control? Mm-hmm. And both of us, maybe we each have our own control domains and freakouts, but we were both really interested in a collaboration and something different, and I for sure thought it was like a refreshing break from like being an echo chamber in my own mind. So I got to go like hang out in your brain.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing was that I was so amazed that everything she was doing I liked so much. Yeah. And so I felt like I was just in completely safe hands, and which seems like, oh, she's so laid back, you know, I'm so not laid back. And normally this would just, I couldn't even imagine doing a collaboration with someone because it just seemed like it would be just so annoying. And it was fantastic. So
you went into this thinking like it was going to be torturous?
Yeah, definitely.
So why did you, like, why did you think it had to be a graphic project?
You know, I always imagined it as a graphic novel. I mean, it was never anything else. It was just, I had been reading so many graphic novels and I loved them so much. They were so beautiful and profound, and I just loved what they could do on the page and that the way you could take words away. And so I just wanted to do one so badly. But so for so long, I was just, every time I would talk to an artist and give them a couple pages to do, I was just disliked it so intensely that I just thought this was never going to work. Mm. And then I just put it in the closet. I was just, forget it, I don't want to do it, and whatever. And then a couple years went by, and then my friend Lee, just one time we were out getting drunk, and I told her about this graphic novel that I had in the closet, and she said, you know what, then she called me 2 months later and said, I'm working for this, you know, Catapult, you know, press, and you should send us the book. And then she actually bugged me for months. I was just too, because I was like, oh yeah, I cannot. That's just, I can't face doing a collaboration. And but then it worked out beautifully. I couldn't believe how amazing it was. So
yeah. I think Daphne is such an interesting character, and she's like messy and like makes big mistakes. I just wonder if you guys could talk about her character, and I have theories, but I want to hear you guys kind of talk about her and like that role for women in literature, because it feels to me like a not super common character.
I think I wanted a character that I was putting pressure on in every way that I could. I just wanted her life to just be pressing in on her, and just like the walls are coming in and everything she does goes wrong and every choice she makes is the wrong choice, and everyone you know, she loves is getting away from her, or she needs to push them away for some reason. So and I just, I mean, I have been in that situation. I mean, that has happened, not those circumstances in particular. Actually, at one point, the birds get bird mites, you know, and they have to put this poison powder over the entire house, you know, and So I had a first marriage. Now this is the real marriage that I have now, this ring, real marriage. But I had a first trial, like a starter marriage. You know? And there was this moment when we got bed bugs and we had to put this powder down over the whole house, and it was just, or apartment, and it was like, there was so much powder. Everyone, it was poison, you know, and it just, and the marriage was just falling apart, you know, it was so horrible. And we tried to vacuum it, and it just created these huge clouds of poison, you know. So we were standing there, we're both completely covered in poison, and just white everywhere, my hair, everything, you know. And I started laughing, you know. And he's like, "It's not funny." I was like, this relationship is going nowhere. And so that just, I think that was sort of the first scene of the book. Like, that was the first thing that I imagined. And I was like, I have to write, that has to be in something that I write. So, and that's sort of a pivotal moment in the book.
Well, I mean, the stakes for her are pretty huge. I mean, I feel like that's not giving anything away if I talk about that, right?
No.
Okay. So, like, she has to keep this job for the boss that she's house-sitting for a certain amount of time so that she can, like, petition to get custody back for her son. So essentially she's like, if the bird mites get all over the house, I'm going to get fired and then I won't get my son. Like, there's just all of these levels of, and then there's like this terrible new wife who is like, just like has it out for her and is like, you know, looking for any excuse. So like she has, like you're saying, all of this pressure surrounding it, this completely absurd situation, which makes it really, I think it's just, it really is like sort of a very cinematographic, like it reminded me of like a brilliant graphic novel mixed with like the premise of like some, you know, slapstick movie where everything goes wrong. Yeah. But, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I really wanted to do that. I went for that, and I mean, I think because I was reading a lot of graphic novels, and I did feel like there weren't a lot of graphic novels that had a lot of plot in them, sort of. And I mean, there were superhero comics and stuff, of course, which have a lot of plot, but I wasn't reading a lot that had sort of like a comedy of manners kind of thing, you know. And so I didn't know anything about comics, but like I did know that. I knew about plot and I know about structure, and so I figured like that could be the thing that I could bring to the table. So
what comics were you reading?
Actually, you know, I taught this comics class, and it's so awful. I decided, oh, I love comics so much, I want to teach a class in it. And, you know, even though I haven't studied it ever, but I'll just learn along the way. And besides, I'm sure I'll know more than them. You know, I know about fiction and stuff, you know. So, but actually people who are into comics are really into comics. Yeah. And they all signed up for my class because it's the only comics class. And there were three students in the class who ran this podcast in where they interviewed graphic novelists around the world, and they were in my class. And then there were kids who their father had owned the local comic book store, and they'd grown up in it. And there were two of them. And then there were several graduate students who were doing graphic novels as their thesis, you know. And so they were in my class, and they were at the Art Institute, and they drove an hour to come to my class. So, and I knew nothing. And they were just, they were appalled. They would be like, "It's Doucet." Like, I didn't know how to pronounce the names of the people. And so eventually after a few, and I brought in Understanding Comics. Mm-hmm. And I was so proud of myself. I was like, oh, I'm going to be the, you know, we're going to bring, but they had all read it, were all so over it, had moved so far beyond it. And, you know, what's next, you know? So eventually what I did was I said, you know what? Class presentations. Who's your favorite comic book artist, you know? And so they all took turns, and they all were trying to impress each other.
Yeah.
So they brought in weirder and crazier stuff. So I got a really good education.
Tell them about the comics. So,
and then in the evaluations they wrote, you know, there was very little teaching in this class. And one person wrote, "I'm very proud of Deb for teaching this class."
That was a conversation between Deb Olin Unferth and Elizabeth Hadel from Lit Crawl PDX from 2017's Portland Book Festival, presented by Bank of America. The 2018 lineup has just been announced, and the festival will take place on November 10th in downtown Portland. For more information about the author lineup, schedule, and tickets, visit literary-arts.org. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. The show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.